The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Now I'm joined by Barbara Scully, broadcaster and writer, and Craig Hughes, political editor of the Irish Daily Mail, to look at Saturday's news. And we start with an area that is squarely in Craig's wheelhouse, which is coalition talks. I think it is the Indo that is reporting that coalition talks, or rather the Times, I should say, reporting coalition talks accelerating. There is a desire to get this done and dusted.
There is, but of course the substantive issues were revealed in the Irish Daily Mail earlier this week. My colleague John Lee with the scoop on how the respective division of government ministries is going to be laid out. So you'll have an 8-7 split in terms of cabinet ministries in favour of Fianna Fáil. Micheál Martin will also go first as Taoiseach.
No cabinet ministries for independence?
No. At the moment, what has been pushed back is that the Ciarán Cormac role was seen as that offering there. They will have at least one super junior ministry, with perhaps another one being created for Michael Healy-Ray, which will give us four. And interestingly, on the kind of division, and sorry, just to go back a step then, so through the weekend now, you'll have the regional independence, which is, of course, you know, Michael Lowry, Sean Canny, and that crew of seven. And they're locked in talks now for the weekend, as are the Healy Rays and the government. And we're kind of approaching the end game on all this. But I will stress that, so Fianna Fáil have scheduled a parliamentary party meeting for Wednesday to discuss the programme for government. That's been seen as perhaps a bit too premature by the Fine Gael side of the house. They said, look, things are going well, but we haven't dealt with any of the tricky stuff yet.
Now, can I ask you on this, Craig? Because I have talked to a number of members of the respective parties, and they've said it's extremely difficult to get together a complex thing like a programme for government. And my question has been all the time, but surely it is a continuum of pre-existing policy in much area. So how much fighting can there be to get a programme to government?
No, and especially it's a lot easier this time around, really, because the bulk of it has been trashed out by two parties, not three. And then they go to the regional independents, who are much more, you would say, ideologically aligned with them than the Greens would have been. So to say, for example, yesterday now, you would have had, there was a full plenary session, right, which was any of the difficult stuff from the week that wasn't agreed upon was kind of trashed out again. And then beyond that, it gets kicked up to the leaders. But look, so I think just the 22nd, the dissolve resumes on the 22nd. It's Taoiseach Simon Harris is even saying that date, while it is the deadline they've set themselves, it still could be a bit too challenging. So you could be looking at the week after that. But just on the division of the ministries, there are some interesting things there, as we were reporting in the Mail earlier this week. So Fianna Fáil will keep housing. Darragh O'Brien will most likely stay there. Fine Gael will keep the Department of Enterprise, but it'll be kind of beefed up with kind of a bit of climate and energy in there. Helen McEntee likely to get that. But then there is a kind of a broad swapping of the departments. So Justice, which will have added integration to it, going to Fianna Fáil. Social Protection going to Fianna Fáil.
Does that mean Jim O'Callaghan, or do we know?
Well, Jim O'Callaghan has also been touted to perhaps have to take up the role of the Attorney General. Which, while not common to have a TD there, is not unprecedented.
Can you be a sitting TD and AG at the same time? Yes.
Yeah.
You don't have to step down.
No, I don't think so. So I'll just have to see clarity on that. But I mean, then you have an interesting thing about who would be justice. So you'd have the two Jameses. James Brown and James Lawless both vying for that portfolio. I think James Lawless was chair of the Justice Committee, did quite well. And also, Chris Crucially, I think in electoral politics, will say he brought in a running mate with him, whereby James Brown, you know, did very well at the gambling control legislation. So there's a lot of to and fro in there. The two finance ministries will swap back. So Fianna Fáil will take the Department of Public Expenditure, while you'll expect Pat Donoghue to be going back into finance on the Fine Gael side. I guess what hasn't been decided yet is what to do with the kind of three Green Party portfolios. You know, they're quite broad. So as I said, children will lose the integration side of it. But then, like, when you have the kind of environment, transport, Catherine Martin's old one then of communications and get all these things smattered together, they haven't decided on how stripped back they will be. So that's kind of one outstanding thing. But again, these are kind of, I would like to, the broad brushstrokes of the coalition deal are
and any significant rebrands, because this kind of thing brings an opportunity for somebody to say, let's take a department and call it something totally different, or give it a remit it didn't used to have. Are they doing any of that?
Well, I mean, I guess there is a small question mark over whether deeper will be shaken up a bit more, or whether there'll be a kind of an infrastructure, stronger infrastructure element to that. I don't see there being a separate standalone Department of Infrastructure, despite that advice being given to the Taoiseach by when he took office. But the big change we'll have with integration going in with justice, that'll be quite significant. It didn't really make sense. Integration being with children of all places, it kind of came
it
about.
It always logically should have been in justice, one would have thought.
Yeah, but what happened was the Green Party wanted to end direct provision, right? This is how, you know, at this, when the talks had been done back then, the Green Party wanted to end direct provision. They said, look, we'll take it. Helen McEntee in justice was delighted. They almost doing a little jig, because one of the most questions they were being asked upon back then was on direct provision. So they were able to get rid of that. But then, of course, when we saw the crisis that we've had around migration, this kind of unintended consequence of this being in another unit over there played out. And so this will go back to the Fianna Fáil play of wanting to have a kind of a Department of kind of Homeland Affairs, beef it up a bit more that way, which we haven't had previously. So I think that's probably the most significant one there.
Is there an element, Barbara, do you think, in this of be careful what you wish for? Because Fianna Fáil in the election campaign was so critical in respect of justice that now there's an element of, all right, let's see how well you do.
I don't know. The whole thing about the coalition talks I have absolutely zilcho interest. After the general election, when we voted in exactly basically the same crew as have been there for the last 10 years, and we still have a housing crisis that has gotten worse in that time rather than better, I just find the whole thing supremely depressing. I also find it very depressing, and I am not a big fan of the Green Party per se, but I think they did some really good stuff when they were in, and I think the fact that they got so roundly trounced at the polls is very depressing. You know, they seem to. And
they're
anybody
having,
that
they're
I
having
have
a national convention tomorrow, isn't that right?
Today.
And I mean, anybody I've spoken to, just kind of casually about this, the Green Party seem to have lost out so much because they introduced cycle lanes, which at a time when the planet is kind of on fire is, I don't know, I find the whole thing kind
well,
of...
Well, I refer you to our colleague Craig Hughes for a more detailed explanation of why that might... there were issues beyond cycle lanes, Craig,
yes,
as I understand.
And as someone who doesn't drive and only cycles, I was all in favour, I was full square behind their pursuit of more cycle lanes. I think it is a great, a serious puzzlement to, I guess, the Green Party, as you say, the world is burning, how people... at a higher rate than ever, how people don't get on board with the green message. And I think it's difficult because you also have people on the opposite side of the political divide. In some senses, you know, you've some who deny climate change at all, and then you've others who say, well, look, the economy matters more so than that, which I guess can be quite short-sighted when you see the devastating impacts. First of all, in our country, when you see the impact of flooding, and of course you need to look across the Atlantic to the US at the moment. So I guess it's been very difficult for green parties across Europe to keep that message going. We saw the kind of green wave that came in 2020, and now it's dissipated. And that's been the real challenge. No one wants to get told, sorry, you can't fly on as many holidays next year. You know, it's the medicine is tough and the patient doesn't seem to want it.
Well, it's funny, we'll be talking about him in a different context later on, but I was very intrigued to see a tweet, I think yesterday, from Elon Musk saying that while climate change risk is real, it's not nearly as immediate and urgent as the scaremongers would have you believe. Mm. Now, when the producer, the world's largest producer of electric vehicles is saying, lads, you don't need to worry too much. Mm. If anything gives an indication that green wave has rolled significantly back.
I don't understand that, I really don't understand it, but anyway.
While we're talking tech, front of the Irish Times, Barbara, there's a story saying that an AI body which reports to the Department of Justice or advises the Department of Justice and beyond is warning of facial recognition creep.
I didn't know until I read this piece that we had such a thing as an AI advisory council, but apparently we do. And as you say, they have sounded caution around using artificial intelligence for facial recognition. Now, obviously, this would be something that if the Gardaí, you know, it would save a lot on Garda time looking for suspects, finding who did what, where. It might also help with missing people and all of that kind of stuff. But they have warned against a creep towards untargeted mass surveillance in the state, which And obviously worried that they will wrongly that AI will wrongly identify people. I was laughing outside when I was reading the piece because it mentions, you know, for AI to work correctly most of the time, it has to have things like good lighting and all that kind of stuff, which is something being married to a photographer, I'm always hearing about. And obviously in situations where there is crimes being committed, etc., there isn't necessarily generally going to be great lighting around that. So we can understand.
Although it was fascinating, if you look at the murder of the UnitedHealth CEO, the level of photography, the level of pictures that were available of the suspect in that, taken from police cars, from CCTV, from inside and outside. I mean, effectively, he was visually trained. I remember years ago, I got run into by a Dublin bus and I got in touch thinking, this is going to take forever.
And you said, got run into by a Dublin bus?
No, in my car, not me on foot. Okay. I'm not that resilient.
You're not dead.
No. So I got in touch with Dublin bus and said, and they said, we'll check the cameras. What cameras? And they came back and they had footage of the entire incident from about 12 different angles off the bus, said, yeah, our fault, no bother, and they sorted it. I mean, couldn't have been nicer about it, but I was amazed, every single bus festooned with cameras.
But I think that's what we all expect now, that there is CCTV everywhere and that we are being watched everywhere, and also we ourselves are using, you know, like facial recognition technology in our phones and all the rest of it, which we feel, one thing that I wish that this would lead to, the whole thing about facial recognition, is that I have a big problem in the fact that we still, in 2025, are not allowed to smile in our passport photographs because presumably the facial recognition technology might recognize as if we're smiling.
And I have a problem.
It doesn't make any sense. And you know something? As you get older and your face starts to go south, it's actually really necessary for you to smile, because otherwise you look like, you do look like a serial killer or a mass murderer or something like that. So I wish that would be changed.
Yeah, I think what the Irish Times article doesn't mention is the, I guess, the civil liberties aspect of it. And do we really want to be walking down the street and have our face analysed every step of the way? I don't think we do.
And that's the critical thing. Not only just pictured, analysed, logged, searched, catalogued.
Yeah, and I know the, and you know, I think I know that Helen McAlee had been pushing to bring this forward. I mean, I understand the logic of, okay, it'll save a lot of guard and manpower time. I understand that, and you know, there'd be safeguards around it. But I think when we've seen, I guess, safeguards not really being adhered to in other areas, that the fact that we would think that this is going to be really, you know, strictly used technology, I think might be a bit fanciful.
But I'm sure the guards will look on the other hand of that and they say, take something like the Dublin riots. If we have the capacity to AI search the images that are logged on Garda cars, on Dublin buses, on CCTV, we can track these people when they put the masks on and then prosecute them for what they do when their faces are obscured.
Yeah, but the other side of that is, Anton, you know, we could allow law enforcement to follow us ever we want, and of course, would we not have a much safer society? But it's I guess the trade-off of what you give away in your freedoms, and that is a debate that should be happening in the Oireachtas and in situations like this, and not kind of silently creeping into our lives.
But surely we're being watched all the time anyway. It's just a question of them being able to use AI, isn't it, to identify us and to search footage. You know, but we are being watched anyway. Like every time you go out the door, you're probably being watched.
Yeah, but you're supposed to be, for example, with CCTV, you're supposed to be told that if you're in an area with CCTV, you're being watched. But that's what the law
says. Just so you're both aware, you're both currently in there. The cameras were a clue, but in case you didn't spot it. Now, while we're talking tech, this brings us to the big shift that we're seeing, particularly with the social media giants, Barbara. We have Elon Musk now fomenting dissent in European states. We saw his interventions in the UK. We see him now intervening in Germany. We've seen him intervening in Ireland off the back of the Dublin riots before. And now Mark Zuckerberg has taken a whiplash turn to the right, joining Donald Trump in a battle against European regulation so that there won't be, quotes, censorship. In other words, there can be a free-for-all online to say what you like. Worrying times.
Yeah, no, it is worrying times. And as somebody who's a very enthusiastic user of social media, it is something that I'm starting myself to find, like, I'm an oversharer. I was always very comfortable in, you know, playing around with Instagram and before that with Twitter. And I mean, I've left Twitter, but I haven't left Twitter. I haven't cancelled my account, but I don't go there anymore because I just find it has changed so much and is just, you know, I don't see any value in it anymore at all. And this week when Mark Zuckerberg announced that he was kind of rolling back on fact-checking supposedly to allow more kind of freedom of speech, etc., does make a lot of people, including myself, very uneasy. But I think that you know, because you kind of get the feeling that you're being sucked into this mad world, this Trumpian kind of like mad world full of hate and misogyny and all kinds of other things. But I do think this is a business decision, obviously, on behalf of Meta, in that, you know, false posts spreading false information spread 20 times faster than posts that are telling the truth, according to an article I read in The Guardian. The engagement is key to the success of social media, to keep people on social media, keep them scrolling. We're all the product. So the more time we spend on there, the bigger the profits of social media.
And the angrier you are, the more you engage.
Yeah, the more you're engaged. So, you know, I think we need to recognize that. And I think that that's still something that a lot of us are only starting to recognize now. But I do know from, as I say, spending too much time on Instagram, that a lot of people are starting to feel uneasy about it. And actually, since Christmas, literally last week, because I use Instagram a lot for promoting various other things that I might be doing, I've now set up a Substack account so that I have more control, I feel, over it. Because again, you're just aware that goalposts are shifting and the ground is shifting.
And it's interesting to see the way they're shifting, because it isn't just in terms of the content policies in Meta. We see this week that Meta, which is a gigantic company with its European headquarters in Ireland, it's now shifting its policy in relation to hiring of minorities, hiring of women, using of companies as third-party suppliers who have a policy of supporting minorities. All of that is being stripped out. Now, they have a nice term for what is effectively survival of the fittest, but that's where we're now heading. Big rowing back of any of those kind of commitments to diversity that the organisations want. It makes you look at the previous policies and think, was that all just guff?
Well, of course it was, and that's what, and it comes from the top down. So I mean, when you had Zuckerberg appearing to be a kind of liberal, democratic supporter, I mean, that's because that's what they felt the wind was blowing. And you see this shift now towards Trump. You know, surprise, surprise, why? Because that's where the power is going. And I guess across Europe, across the United States, we have seen this significant shift to the right, you know.
Now, can I ask, Craig, how much does this put it up to the EU, and how good will the EU be in response? Because effectively what the total ideology now in the US is free for all. They package it as freedom of speech, but effectively it means unregulated disinformation or misinformation. Mm. Europe has gone for a long time very much the other way and has been strongly along those lines. Yeah. Do we have the capacity to say, okay, we'll get into this fight?
Well, do you know what? I hope so, because I can, in our profession, if we say something, you know, wrong about someone in our newspaper or on the radio station, you know, it costs a significant amount of money. It's filleted newsrooms across Irish newspapers, that has led to the reduction of the capacity of the industry to produce good journalism. But yet you see different standards, you know, being applied to these, you know, multi-billion euro companies that are based here. Now, there might be a reticence on the Irish government to be the first one to tackle it, because they might go elsewhere in Europe. But the European Union as a bloc should be a leader in this, you know.
It's high-stake stuff, though, when you have when you have Musk and Zuckerberg and the US administration in lockstep. You're really want to commit if you want to get into that battle.
That's true, but I mean, some battles are worth fighting. And I think if we don't take action here as the EU, I just wonder where it goes. And you know, if you're to walk away from every challenging issue because, you know, the money says not to, well, then is that a society you want to live in?
And it goes right to the very heart of what we stand for and what we stand for as people and as, you know, humanity. I think it's really, really important that that the EU does stand up.
We've been very good, though, at standing for stuff without having to put economic or military might behind it. And it looks like, I mean, how much do we care about Greenland? How much do we care about social regulation? Are we willing to get into a tariff war over it? Sorry, I'm not saying we shouldn't. But it's a big shift for the EU in terms of foreign policy if we're heading in that direction.
Well,
isn't it?
I think if on the Greenland one, I think for Europe's borders to be to be encroached, I think that would be a significant shift. And you've seen Germany and France say that back to Donald Trump, who I think is perhaps probing and testing the waters before he takes office.
One final thing before we wrap up, let's end up on a positive note, particularly for Barbara, who is delighted by the news that the Birkenstock, which is those sandals of dubious appearance, which you love.
I
take it back. Sorry, I don't know what I was saying.
Word set against Birkenstocks.
They may end up being codified as art.
Art, yeah, by judges in Germany and the High Court in Germany are apparently looking at this as to whether Birkenstocks should be protected as works of that come under the thing of literature, science and art.
These were like Crocs of the 1970s.
No, they're not like Crocs at all. No, Crocs were an aberration and were dreadful. No, as somebody who's 6 foot tall and has never, ever worn heels in my life, the Birkenstocks are just the most comfortable, most fabulous shoes, and I'm a
huge
fan.
These are the leather strap buckle sandals,
yeah,
isn't that right?
Yeah, they're very, very comfortable. They've got cork soles and they are kind of like designed to fit. They're just so cool. Have you ever worn a pair of Birkenstocks?
God, no.
Oh, you'll never go back. Once you put them on your little feet, you would never go back. And I'm actually even the owner of
Crocs?
No, not Crocs. What are they? Clogs. Do you know the closed? I own Birkenstock clogs, which are very, very trendy.
Are they wooden topped or are they
leather topped? No, they're not. Now, I'm old enough to remember when we had a clog shop here in town in the early 80s and the late 70s where you could buy proper Dutch clogs. And I did wear those as well, which were wooden soles. Wooden ones. Yeah, they make your feet really smelly. Wooden ones with leather on the top. Yeah, I clumped around in those.
I believe medics wear clogs a lot.
Yes, they would. But I think they wear Crocs.
Can we all just agree on a general consensus that Crocs are awful?
Yeah,
Crocs are awful, great. But Birkenstocks are fabulous.
Barbara
fabulous.
Scully, broadcaster, writer, Birkenstock owner, and Craig Hughes, political editor of the Irish Daily Mail. Thank you both very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.